Welcome to Homemade is Best with Helena Brigman and Russ Turley. This is show number 24, the cheese episode. Hello and welcome back to Homemade is Best. It's me, Russ Turley. It's her, Helena Brigman. She runs a website, Clearly Delicious, clearlydeliciousfoodblog.com. What's going on, Helena?
Hey, Russ. I am so excited by how you just introduced us. It's me. It's her. It's she. Actually, I think it's grammatically she.
Did I mess up? That's all right.
No, it's whatever. It's like a common... spoken English is not the same as written English. So,
Exactly. Well, you know, and I live in Long Beach, where, you know, for shizzle is a acceptable term to use. So...
I like the fact that you even use the word for shizzle.
You know, I don't know.
Because you know that's not the correct pronunciation. For shizzle.
Faux.
Hey, question. What does Snoop Dogg say when it rains?
I don't know.
The drizzle drizzle. Something like that. I'm probably destroying the joke.
That was probably
welcome wrong. To Homemade is Best.
Wow. That's... how are you? It's been a little bit of time, and so how's the thing? How have things been on the Clearly Delicious food blog in particular?
Things have been great. Actually, things are extremely well, which is part of the reason why we haven't had a chance to record. I have a super secret food project that I'm working on, and you know about it, Russ, but I'm not really ready to kind of announce it to the world until it's like signed, sealed, and delivered. But just know that good things are happening over at Clearly Delicious and in the Brigman food writing world, which I'm very excited about.
Well, now I feel like I've got something special inside me.
Yeah.
This secret.
It is secret. Don't tell anyone. I really want to make it my Facebook status. I am dying to make it my Facebook status.
Oh,
but, you know, I don't want to jinx my extremely good luck, you know, my good fortune. So maybe next time when we talk, I'll have something cool to report. But things are good at Clearly Delicious, and I'll actually talk about one of the good things in a minute.
Well, good. Well, let's talk about first. Is there any clarifications, any corrections on something we said in the past? Anything that we want to fix?
So far, good. We haven't dropped any swear words, and we haven't confused anyone in England. So we're good for today.
Ah, excellent. Good. Then I have to say, we didn't talk about this. So I want to talk about this bag. And this went by in the last show and untalked about the unicorns, the unicorn song.
The unicorns. Oh, my God. Enlighten us. I know what this is, but I don't know if our listeners have checked this out.
Well, they had to because it was in the end of two shows ago. It was tacked on to the end of the show. And after the ending music, if you stuck around for the last little bit of the show and you waited, there was a little pause there at the end, and then started the unicorn song. And
I love the unicorn song. It's going to be on my running mix.
And did you happen to catch a bit on the end about the vampires?
You know, I did, and I really appreciate you putting that in there, because unicorns are real, unlike vampires, or something like that. Whatever it was that you said, it was cute.
Yeah, so that was part of the show. It was the inside thing there that was going on in the show, and so I put that in there as well. But anyway, that song was actually interesting. Was one that my wife's uncle always sang to her when she was a little kid, and she loved that song. He was he was part of the New Christy Minstrels, which was kind of a folk group, and so he was a guitar player, banjo player, and he would always sing that song to her. She loved it, and I learned it just so I could sing it to the kids and have fun with it. But
that is so cute.
That was the first time I'd ever recorded on the GarageBand here on the Mac. So hope you enjoyed that. If you didn't, you probably won't have a repeat performance. But if you want to listen to it, go back a couple shows and you'll find it.
Thanks for reminding us of that, Russ, because that really was like such a little treat to wake up to in my inbox one morning when you recorded it. I think you said you had to get a little sauced in order to record it. The impression it was some kind of drunken bar song you had come up with when you were younger. But I like that it has this family tie.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's the only unicorn song I know, so that was I had to record that one. But you can't record the fingers don't work when you're drinking. So there was no alcohol used in the recording of that. So no, it's clean in all aspects.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Well, good. Well, let's get on then. Talk about what Helena excited about.
Yeah. What is Helena excited about? This is, as always, my favorite section because I get to kind of integrate Clearly Delicious a little bit more into this podcast. And this week, I'm extremely excited about two kind of cool products that are online and that I've recently been with. The first one is a product by a brand called Stonehouse 27. It is just so cool, Russ. One of the best things about being a food blogger is that you get to enjoy these kind of little perks that kind of come up. And one of the little perks is that I get to be involved with the companies, like, I know we've talked a lot about Mark's Foods and a lot of the olive oil companies that I work with, and it's just fun because they send you samples, you get to cook with these incredible ingredients that you might otherwise have to pay for, and all they're looking for is a recipe development that they can put on their website. So it's this beautiful symbiotic digital relationship. And they feed me, so it's cool. But Stonehouse 27 is an exotic Indian kind of brand that you can get at places like Whole Foods and throughout the country, more like specialty stores. And it's so great because I am a big fan of eating healthy food as often as possible. And when you're a food blogger, it becomes a little bit problematic to do that because we have things like Paula Deen frying butter. And there's this perception that unless you're doing something really fattening, it's not always going to be good. But I think you and I both know that, you know, fresher is better and just stuff that's good for you is often better. So I want to give a shout out to Stonehouse 27 because they sent me a jar of their dates and tamarind sauce this week.
Oh, I was going to say, I hope that's what you're going to say because that sounds so good.
It is unreal. If you ever Google image search a tamarind root, you're going to laugh hysterically because it looks like toes or something Freudian. But I was trying to figure out what tamarind was earlier this week when I was working with it. But they sent me this great little tamarind sauce and a rice bowl from a company named Lundberg Family Farms. Lundberg is really easy to find. They're at, you know, Fresh Market, Whole Foods. You might even have them at Trader Joe's, Russ. And they were just like, hey, develop this recipe using any three ingredients to add to this dish and then post it on your blog. And we'll be greatly we'll be so nice. We'll give out 5 free samples to any of your listeners, so our readers. So listeners, go over to Clearly Delicious, find the most recent post for pork with tamarind and dates, comment on the post, and go to Facebook and like these two companies, and you could very good chances win a free rice bowl and one of these awesome jars. And then one last thing, the most important thing about Stonehouse 27 that I really think should be mentioned is the extremely healthy ingredients that they put into these sauces. There is not a single preservative. There are no artificial colors or foods. When you read the instructions or the ingredients, it literally says dates, tamarind, this kind of Indian sauce. And so it's gluten-free, low sodium, low fat. Just incredible.
Well, it's neat. You know, it was funny because one of my favorite little drinks when you go to a Mexican restaurant is a tamarindo, which it's the tamarind and it's boiled and they put a little bit of sugar in it but it's very kind of sweet. It's kind of got a weird kind of little. If it was a rabbit, I would call it gamey. It's kind of a it's a different taste, but it's really good.
Oh, good. Okay. So is it at all spicy by any chance?
No, it's not.
Okay. The tamarind root isn't typically spicy, but they always tend to mix it with some kind of heaty item. So so I was kind of wondering if they embrace that in your cocktail.
Oh, and you can get, well, here I don't know about there in Louisiana, but here you can get the tamarindo also in a bottle. You can take it home with you. And just, it's like a soda.
Oh.
So it's not at all. It's sweet and it's... And delicious, but it's not not at all spicy. That part's taken out of it if it's got any of it in it at all.
Well, Russ, if you like tamarind so much, go comment on my post, go like these on Facebook, and I can almost guarantee you I will put your name in the pool for the winners of the free sauce.
Oh, all right.
It's good to know people in high blogging places.
I bet. All right, good.
And by high blogging places, I mean my little house in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. So yeah, I love tamarind. It's one of my new things. And seriously, Russ, feel free to Google tamarind root at any point and then giggle.
All right. So when was the other one here? You had Lundberg Family.
Oh yeah, Lundberg Family Farms is the ingredient that I mixed with this. They do these really healthy rice bowls. They're like two servings or a single serving of rice in these rice bowls, and they're super impressive because you take this rice bowl and you peel it open, put it in the microwave for 60 to 90 seconds, excuse me, and just after that, you add a tablespoon of water, kind of heat it up over the stove, and within 2 or 3 minutes, it's basically done. So it's this, and they're really healthy. I did the long grain brown rice, and it was super delicious.
You know what? You hear a lot more talk about gluten-free right here on the Lundberg.com website. Experience gluten-free. And
yes.
I listen to another podcast, and the guy that does that podcast, he's like, oh, it's the glutens are getting you. And so just things getting into my brain. So I keep reading more about it. And, so do you know anything about the glutens?
Well, I was about to ask you the same thing because, as a food blogger, the only thing I really know about gluten-free is that it's a serious allergy. And Elise over at Simply Recipes, one of my favorite food blogs, she has a gluten allergy. So a lot of times she'll see gluten-free versions of her recipes. And one of my best friends and one of my bosses, they both have the same, you know, they both have the same allergy. So if I bring muffins to work, they're not going to eat them because they can't. So, I mean, what's the deal with kind of eating? What do you know about eating it as a, just an option, like choosing to be gluten-free or eating
It's kind of like having a milk allergy.
I see.
Casein, I don't know how you say that one. That's the protein in milk.
Mm-hmm.
Gluten is the protein found in things like wheat and grains, uh-huh. like barley and rye. And
yeah.
So if you're allergic to it, I mean, and you know this thing. If you're allergic to it, then you have a problem, and you heard people have celiac disease.
They have
a problem, but now I haven't done all my due diligence here. So if you know about this, go ahead and email. That'd be great.
Yeah, that would be great. That's a good point, Russ.
Yeah, I'm just getting involved in this, and I'm reading up on it, and trying to get my head around what it is exactly. But it's basically a low level. Even people who can eat glutens might be somewhat allergic. They're just, their body has secretes this other enzyme that takes care of it. That does not, or it's not normal. They don't have to, but when you eat like something dodgy, say like a gluten, that your body like takes care of it. It's like when you drink alcohol, you know, okay, that's,
yeah.
your liver says, hey, I got to get this out of here. This is a toxin. I got to get it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think supposedly your body treats glutens the same way. So,
interesting.
I need to find out more about that. But I was hoping you knew that I could just.
Well, I do.
Reduce my research.
I'm not gonna name any names for the people in my life, but I do know that the people that I do know, generally speaking, who have this allergy, I mean, it's kind of a kind of branch off of other existing digestive problems they have. So, there's just a lot of weirdness in the food we eat, Russ. I mean, with all the preservatives and all the craziness. So I guess kind of going back to Stonehouse 27, these two companies are great in that it's organic and it's just very natural. And I think that, you know, it's hard to go into a store, pay what you would hope to pay in terms of a budgeted grocery list and get these things that are good for you. So go Lundberg Family Farms. And maybe that's what we can do. Let's do a gluten-free podcast, Russ.
That would be fun. Yes.
Yeah. And I'm sure that we have... We have plenty of listeners who would need that.
And I'll definitely have more information about why you would even want to be gluten-free.
Yeah. Because your tummy hurts or something. I don't
right.
know.
Right. Well,
we'll be more sophisticated about it, listeners, next time.
Your tummy hurts, and so you don't eat the glutens.
Yes.
It sounds like it's some kind of like a foreign body. The glutens are here to get you.
For sure. Yes. So I guess that's it for Lundberg Family Farms. But we have other exciting stuff for us.
Yes. Now, we talked about previously about making homemade cheese, and you've made it a reality here with some recipes. We're going to make our own cheese today.
Okay. So we had gotten a listener email requesting that we discuss cheese and homemade cheese. And instantly you and I just kind of knew this was a perfect topic for Homemade is Best because we always go out to the store and buy cheese all the time. I mean, I don't think I have ever actually sat down and really made cheese, although I've made cheese at other people's houses and I've certainly seen it made in restaurants, but I've never actually kind of thought to myself, I can make this pastry, but you know what would be great inside this pastry? Homemade goat cheese. So it hasn't really been one of those things that I've kind of embarked upon, but I'm super excited to talk about it.
Yeah, well, I have zero experience making cheese. My only, and I think I've mentioned reference like this multiple times, is I Love Lucy. One time,
yes.
they made, you know, we had talked about on the bread episode, I believe, or one of the bread episodes, that, you know, there's a giant loaf that came flying out of this this oven. But also at the same one, I believe they tried to churn butter, and she dumped milk into this butter churn, and decided she was just going to move it up and down and move it around and make butter. And doing it was, then she found out later that you can't actually do it that way. But I'm interested to know, how can I make my own, not butter, but also cheese out of this? So how do you do this?
Sure. I did some research before. You know, I kind of selected the four recipes we're going to talk about today. But in general, cheese made in the home is extremely easy. You take mostly household kitchen kind of pots and pans and utensils you use for everything else, and then you add gallons of milk to it and start stirring and adding certain ingredients that'll help it to kind of curdle or do other things that are going to create different kinds of cheese. So let's start off with the first one, which I'm definitely going to have to make over Clearly Delicious, because not only is it incredibly easy, but it also looks delicious. I'm not a big fan of ricotta cheese in the store, so I'm kind of excited to see what ricotta cheese made with whole milk is going to be like. So this recipe is for a simple, rich, homemade ricotta from Smitten Kitchen, Deb's blog on the internet, and it's incredible, Russ. Just looking at this just looks so delicious and fresh and exciting.
Yeah, this is not, we're not talking about cheddar cheese here. We're not talking about sliced cheese. We're talking about soft cheese. This is like a spreadable cheese.
Yes, these are actually, I'm glad you clarified that, Russ, because I don't think we're ever going to be able to talk about how to make cheddar cheese. But I do know that we can talk about soft cheeses like ricotta and mozzarella, and we will talk about feta. So just white soft cheeses that we often just grab at the store, they're better and cheaper, significantly cheaper if you make them at home.
Well, this is, yes, because I know that this may be like even like a cream cheese, this looks like. I mean, it's just something like you could, something like you put on anything and just make it delicious.
Oh, sure. She has a bunch of pictures kind of on toasted baguette. And I think it's peeled zucchini or peeled cucumber, but it looks incredible. So let's actually go over the ingredients list here, Russ.
Yeah,
3 cups whole milk. So I'm sure you and I both have that.
That's
in our
it? Kitchen. 3 cups whole milk?
No. 1 cup heavy cream.
Oh, okay.
1 cup heavy cream. A half teaspoon of coarse sea salt. And of course, the rule of thumb, Russ, we've talked about this before. If you don't have coarse salt in the kitchen, just double it and make it regular table salt.
Okay.
So you would use a teaspoon of regular salt. And then 3 tablespoons of freshly squeezed lemon juice. Fresh is always best. But if you have that stuff that, you know, on the bar, some lemon juice on the bar or in the refrigerator, that will work just fine. So, Russ, I already have all this stuff in the kitchen. I can make ricotta cheese tonight.
Yeah, we have like one. I think we have 2% milk, but.
But, and that's actually, I'm glad you said that, because I typically keep skim in my refrigerator,
right?
Because of calories, and I've never really been a big fan of the whole milk movement.
You like the blue milk?
I like the skinny milk. I like the milk that doesn't taste like I'm literally drinking it out of an udder. Ugh. Sorry. That's what I used to say when I was a kid. It would freak me out.
Okay.
Deb did a great experiment here. She says kind of in the instruction section that she tried this ricotta several different ways. One just with milk, one with 2%, and one with skim. And guess what? They're pretty much indistinguishable. So I think it's really that addition of heavy cream that's going to balance out the kind of creaminess or the fat content that's going to be coming from the whole milk. So whatever milk you have in your fridge, just as long as you've got 3 cups to 1 cup heavy cream, you should be fine.
Okay, good. Well, that makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, so technically we should close this podcast, and you know, I get so excited about recipes, I'm going to go make some ricotta cheese. But it's super easy, Russ. The technique here is pretty much just a combination of heating, warming, and removing from the heat. But in order for this to be successful, there are some special ingredient or tools that you're going to need to use. A lot of times we just refer to, you know, bowls and spoons, but this is an example of where utensils in the kitchen are extremely important. So a cooking thermometer, for one, is the number one ingredient because you have to monitor the temperature during the cooking process. It can't go above 190 degrees. And the other thing that you're going to need is a colander and cheesecloth to help kind of sift the actual cheese content from any of the oily or milky residue that might be left over.
It's the actual real reason you use a cheesecloth, not to, I say, strain, I don't know, bits out of your engine oil or something like that. Did you want to, like...
Exactly.
I don't know. So anything else, guys, I don't think I can think of. I remember doing that with my old Volkswagen when I was like, oh, there's a part. There's metal in the engine case. And then so you put it through some cheesecloth.
Yes. Well, it's true. I love that you said that because we take for granted that cheesecloth is literally made for cheese. For one of the steps we're going to be discussing here. So let's jump into the actual technique. It's extremely quick. It doesn't take much longer than 15 minutes. So what you do is you add the milk, cream, salt, to a 3-quart non-reactive saucepan. Really any non-reactive saucepan is going to
work. Like a stainless steel, maybe.
Stainless steel, yes. Mm-hmm. And the best rule of thumb is if you have a stainless steel pot that has a thick bottom, that's going to work great for all of these because it's going to help prevent scorching and destroying the liquid. So here, and then you want to put your thermometer in the milk. Do you have a kitchen thermometer, Russ?
We have a candy thermometer. We've used that for, I think for fudge, it's used once a year, around Christmas time. But this is the second use now.
Well, perfect. Yeah, because she literally says in the instructions, attach a candy or deep fry thermometer. I have a deep fry thermometer because I live in the South. So I'll be using my deep fry thermometer. You'll be using your candy thermometer.
You can even use a deep thigh thermometer.
Deep thigh.
If you have one of those.
Even if you have one of those, but please sanitize it first because this is cheese that we're dealing with. Okay, so... You want to heat the milk to 190 degrees using that thermometer, and you want to make sure that you're stirring it occasionally to keep it from scorching the bottom. Now, in her original instruction, she had said to turn off the heat and allow it to sit for about 5 minutes after you stirred in the addition of the lemon juice, but really she thinks that you should just kind of remove it from the heat and add the lemon juice and then stir it once or twice, gently and slowly, then let the pot sit undisturbed for 5 minutes. So the lemon juice is always kind of added in the end. And if Alton Brown were here, if we had him as a special guest, I'm sure he could spend 10 minutes explaining how the lemon juice reacts to make this cheese possible and why you add it at the end.
Right. Well, I can imagine that's what makes it curdle and to create that solid out of this mass of liquid.
Yes. We know that's what's going to happen, and it is a result of that lemon juice, but I'm sure there's a whole molecular thing going on.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, there's something else going on we can't see.
Yes. In which Alton Brown would dress up as a molecule and bump into things and say how he's curdling or something.
You're definitely right there.
We should see if there's a cheese episode, because I feel like this is a real thing. Anyway, so after you've let it rest for about 5 minutes, you want to line that colander with a few layers of cheesecloth, because even though there's a netting built into the colander, it's not going to be enough, because you want to retain as much of the curdles as possible, not just the big ones, but the small ones as well. And pour the curds, or pour the mixture from the pot into this kind of apparatus you've created here, but set it over a large bowl so that you can catch what she refers to as the whey. Pour the curds and whey into the colander and let the curds strain for at least an hour. At an hour, you'll have tender, spreadable ricotta. At 2 hours, it will be spreadable but a bit firmer, almost like cream cheese. So this is just kind of, I know. It's just, So don't freak out that you have to kind of let it sit at room temperature because it is a soft cheese and because this is part of the cooking process, you got to let it sit.
So, if we're going to eat it, then would we let it come to room temperature before we eat it? Is that something we should do?
Well, because it's a soft cheese, when it's at room temperature, it increases its spreadability, if that's a word. But you can eat it at room temperature after you immediately prepare it, which I'm sure it tastes delicious and warm and gooey. But most people are probably going to refrigerate it and then use it later. Either way is great for us. Either way is great.
It's interesting that there's no, like, flavorings. It's just cream, milk, a little bit of salt, which, you know, obviously will give you some flavor there. But there's no, like, add some, you know, some flavor to it. I mean, I guess yeah. I haven't eaten enough ricotta to know, like, what that tastes like. Just you know, sitting here.
Yeah, ricotta is one of those kind of blander, on a scale of cheeses, it's going to be, let's say you have, like, sharp cheese on one end, and then you'll have ricotta on the other end. Because okay. it really is one of the blander cheeses, but that's a great thing to have in the kitchen, because you can add it to so many kind of toasted toppings. Like, you'll see it incorporated into a bruschetta or something. But I love ricotta. I recently used it on a kind of, I guess you could call it a scorched eggplant dish, in which I made a tomato salsa with a ricotta and put it on there. So these are there's so many things to do with this cheese. And often you'll just see it served on bread.
Yes. Well, I can just imagine you replacing, say, if you have a bagel in the morning, replacing your cream cheese with this ricotta cheese.
Yeah, exactly. You can kind of, I could see this being integrated as a cream cheese substitute as well, because, I mean, she said it has more of a cream cheese texture to ours. Now, whether or not it tastes like cream cheese is another story.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
We'll have to make this and see what we think.
Well, the thing is, I mean, this is, besides, I don't know if I have any cream right now. I probably do, but you can make this with almost nothing.
It literally is almost nothing. And I think all the time about whenever I'm working a recipe, I just, you know, write down all the things that I need at the store. But there are so many things that I can be making at home. And, you know, cheese is a great example of that. It really takes so little time to make something this essential and this good, and you can save $3 or $4. I mean, why not? I mean, we talked about how delicious and incredible that no-knead bread is that we have been, you know, we just kind of praised in one of the earlier episodes. This is a great example of that. Put some no-knead bread. Life is good. You cooked for maybe 20 minutes. Life is 20-minute meal.
That sounds perfect. I'm gonna go on mic here. Yes, I can imagine doing that exact thing, that homemade bread with a little bit of ricotta cheese on it.
Mm. Yes.
Maybe, and then a little tomato slice on top. I've got my tomatoes in the garden are going crazy right now. It'd be great on top of
that. Gosh, damn you, darn you, pardon my language, my French, darn you California people with your perfect weather, because my tomatoes are dead. They're officially done for the season. But that would be fresh and homemade and perfect. And regardless of the season, I think this is kind of a perfect little thing to just have ready. You know how, I know that you probably know the feeling, Russ, when you have people suddenly coming over and you have nothing to serve them. It's just fun to kind of blow your mind and think of the ways that you can make them something out of nothing.
Yeah, and this really is something that, you know, if you were, it feels very, I don't know, it feels very Little House on the Prairie.
It does feel very Little House on the Prairie. But it's good, you know? Yeah. Let's make Little House on the Prairie modern.
That's a good idea.
Yes.
But let's do the next recipe here, because I peeked ahead here and I've been looking at these pictures and it's very interesting.
Yeah, I gave two recipes for the next one, which is mozzarella cheese. And it's so fun to think that you can make mozzarella cheese at home. Mozzarella is something that I spend way too much money on when I'm on a big pizza cooking kick and when I'm grilling and making paninis. And really, if you have pretty much the same ingredients as ricotta and a little more time and a little more kind of stretching skills, you can make some homemade mozzarella. So if you can master the ricotta, you can pretty much master this mozzarella cheese recipe. So, yes. So let me look at the ingredients list here. The one that I'm going to be reading off of is over at cookitalian.com. It's just kind of a whatever food blog that has some really great step-by-step photo instructions.
Well, it's, and I've said this, the pictures on this one, I mean, make it look just uber simple.
It is extremely uber simple when you put it that way. So this one's great because it kind of has that really educational element that we're looking for in describing how homemade foods are best when they're kind of made in this really easy format. So you're going to need a lot of the same equipment and ingredients from the last recipe. You're going to want a 8-quart pot. They list here stainless steel. Do not use aluminum, cast iron, or other reactive pots. So just make sure you have a clean, regular stainless steel or enamel pot. Typically, you want it to have a thick bottom as well. I have one with a copper bottom that works great. Oh, yes. Again, the same thermometer, some measuring cups, a large strainer, a large sharp knife, a slotted spoon, a large bowl, a small bowl, and a microwave oven.
Ah.
So if you have all those things, you've got the basic equipment to make mozzarella cheese.
Well, it's interesting that they have a microwave oven on here. I mean, this is not your little house on the prairie recipe.
No. This is your little apartment in Soho recipe.
All right, good.
Yeah, so also she lists some nylon netting for draining curds, which, again, we're talking about cheesecloth here. But just reading this instruction, Russ, has me think, if I'm ever out of cheesecloth, I could use a pair of torn nylon.
So, oh, I don't think that's what they meant, is it?
No, but it has the same. As long as you're not using, like, the foot part, I'm sure it's fine and they're clean. I'm just thinking. You know, single women, we got to do what we got to do when we need our cheese.
Put on their clean nylons.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, that makes a whole nother word, cheese. Oh God.
So, whatever you, just go for cheesecloth, people, and you'll be safer. Okay, and then a plain white cloth if you want to make ricotta cheese with the whey that is left over. So this is kind of exciting. If you want to make mozzarella and ricotta, you can technically make ricotta from the leftovers in this recipe. So you can do two recipes in one. Also, you want a small strainer to dip out the curds. And now ingredients. You want a gallon of milk, so we're going to be making a big recipe here. A rennet tablet crushed. Now, a rennet tablet is used to coagulate milk. You can also use liquid rennet if you can get it. And this is just one of those items that you're not going to be able to find at your regular grocery store. We'll have to put a link in the show notes to where you can kind of find this ingredient. And the other thing that's in this list are 2 teaspoons of citric acid. Again, something we'll have to give you a link to, but you can often find it at some health food stores.
Interesting, because citric acid, I would guess this is the, like you said, it's not the Little House on the Prairie version. This is the chemistry version. You know, they're using citric acid instead of lemon juice.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I'll do some more research, see if I can find one that calls for lemon juice over citric acid, just to kind of help out, because we won't have these ingredients necessarily in our kitchen. I certainly don't have a rennet tablet or citric acid.
No.
But I'm sure once you get those things, you're going to be ready to make mozzarella all the time. So it'll probably be, you know, you'll probably have them for a long time. It's like when you buy cornstarch. I don't remember the last time I had to buy cornstarch without it going bad, you know, because it lasts forever.
Yeah. So, otherwise, we just milk and those two ingredients they're talking about, and then water and salt.
And salt
again.
Exactly.
So besides those two, you know, little exotic ingredients.
Yes.
It's very very simple recipe.
Yeah, but note that the water cannot be chlorinated, so you want to use bottled water, which is purified.
Yeah.
So really, this is more scientific. This is more Alton Brown, but it's still very simple. Don't be intimidated by the special requirements here.
This is like the Breaking Bad cheese right here.
Yeah, Breaking Bad cheese. So let's talk about how you do that. How do you break bad? So first, you want to pour your teaspoon of citric acid into 1/4 cup of unchlorinated water and stir. Crush the rennet tablet and pour it into the other cup of unchlorinated water. The citric acid should be dissolved by the time you have to use it. So most of the rennet will be dissolved, but there will still be some residue left, they note here. So if you haven't done so already, pour milk into your pot. So really, you're going to need a huge non-reactive pot here to hold an entire gallon of milk.
That's a gallon of milk. That's a lot of milk.
And it's going to be a lot of mozzarella, Russ. So think about how much do you pay for, you know, how much would you say on average you pay for a regular size block of mozzarella, Russ?
Oh, I don't know. It's been a while.
Maybe $4?
I was going to say $5 probably.
Yeah, $4 to $5. And whereas this is a gallon of milk we're dealing with here. How much does a gallon of milk cost in California?
$4.99.
Okay, it's $4 at my grocery store, but $4.99. So pretty similar in price, but the difference is when you make this kind of homemade mozzarella, you're going to be yielding almost triple batch, $15 probably worth of cheese. So homemade is best, if only from an economic standpoint.
Now, does it mention here whether the milk should be whole milk or does it?
Actually, given the amount of detail on this blog, they don't list the
that's kind of odd.
Yeah, but I'm sure they're kind of assuming that everyone's working with whole milk here because you do want that fat content
when you're making
cheese.
Of course.
Yeah,
that's what it is.
But I'm sure we'll do some research, see if we can do it with skim or with 2%. So add the milk to your pot. Make sure the milk is around 50 degrees when you pour in the citric acid. So it's got to be refrigerated, not at room temperature. So pour in that citric acid and pour the dissolved citric acid in the milk and stir for 1 minute. That's the one that you diluted in the water. Sprinkle the other teaspoon of citric acid in the milk and stir for another minute. You will probably see the milk start to curdle very shortly. Then heat the milk to 88 to 90 degrees. So again, it's important you kind of keep your eye on that temperature, stirring occasionally. You're not trying to pasteurize the milk. Don't overstir it. If you get it too hot or too cold, the rennet will not make curd. So make sure that you keep it kind of in that 88 to 90 degree kind of thing. And it should stay there for about 10 to 15 minutes.
All right. So far, so good. We're not talking about anything too difficult.
Right. It's just making sure that you do the dilution of the kind of acids and rennet properly and that you add it properly and keep your eyes on the temperature. So I would say the ricotta cheese is cheese for beginners. And this cheese is probably cheese for beginners with a little bit of experience because it's not terribly difficult, but you do want to pay close attention to the recipe.
Yes. Sidebar here.
Yes.
I'm on Wikipedia for the fat content of milk. Did you know whole milk?
Uh-oh.
Only 3.25% fat. So 2% fat is probably going to work out just fine.
Really? That's
surprising. Isn't that surprising? I'm looking here. Butter, 80%. Whipping cream, 36. Heavy whipping cream, 36. Whipping cream or light whipping cream, which this would be what we would use for the ricotta, right?
Yes, exactly.
30 to 36%. Medium cream, 25%. Half and half. 10.5% to 18%, like a huge range there on half and half.
Yes.
But whole milk, only 3.25%. So I'm going to say you can go with 2% milk, no problem.
I would say that you're probably totally right, Russ, because the percentages are so minimal. The difference is so minimal. So that's great. That's good to know, Russ. We should do an episode on milk, just in general, because there's a lot to be said there. I know that half and half is, I can't remember, I think it's half milk, half cream, like literally cream, but so that's going to affect the fat content significantly.
Well, that makes sense as far as the percentage wise.
Yeah,
three and thirty.
Yeah, 3 and 30.
About 15 to 18. Sure.
Dang. Okay. Math is hard. So but back to this. And so let's say you do go with the 2% or the whole milk. Going to be pretty much the same thing. I think we can rule out any margin of error there. So when you're at that 15 to 20 minute time point, you want to cover the pot with the lid and leave it to set undisturbed for at least 15 to 20 minutes until you can get a clean break. This person tends to leave theirs up until 30 minutes because time is not critical here, so you don't really need to kind of obsess over whether or not you're checking at it every 5 minutes or something.
What is a clean break?
I'm glad you asked.
I don't know what that means.
I'm glad you asked. So in step 6, he says wait for a clean break. This is what a clean break looks like. When you poke your finger into the mixture and move for an inch or so and fill it out or lift it out, the curd and whey should separate shortly. So if you're looking at this image, this is why this recipe is so great because they really do show you these kind of really important instructions. You see this man testing the mixture, and there's a clean open line where he's broken through the surface of the curd, and you see the whey kind of poking through. If it is still liquid and sticks to your finger, let it set a while longer. So if you go to do this step, but you don't see any kind of change in the texture or the coloring, then just kind of, you know that you need to let it set longer, which I think is probably why he's suggesting 30 minutes and not 20 minutes here.
Well, good. Yeah. So that makes it easy. If it sticks your finger, it's kind of like a cake. If it sticks to the toothpick, it's not done yet.
That's a great analogy, Russ, because that really is the cake. That really is exactly what's going on here. You want to make sure nothing is kind of sticking. You want to make sure there's a difference between what is cooked or being cooked in the process and what is not being cooked. So the next step is great. The opening sentence is cut the curd.
Yeah, and the pictures here explain very well what you... He just looks like he's cross-cutting, making a little checkerboard.
Exactly. He's making a checkerboard. He says to cut the curtain to 1/2-inch cubes from top to bottom as shown, then do the same thing at a 45-degree angle. So you have a little bit of a kind of a texture here. Images, you can see the checker begin to evolve. And then you want to let these kind of chunks sit for an additional 5 to 10 minutes. And he says, just let them sit there. And I like the things that he's stressing in bold, because when you make cheese, especially with mozzarella, there's a lot of handling that you have to do at the end. But in the beginning, it's so essential that you don't overwork it. In our culture, we like to stir everything. I actually hate it when someone comes into my kitchen and starts to try and help me cook. And the only way they know to help me cook is to start stirring what's in the pot. Mm-hmm. I'm like, why are you stirring? I already stirred it. You don't need to keep touching it, you know? So it's one of those things where don't stir. Risk, you know, don't run the risk of overworking it by stirring it too much. Follow these instructions pretty closely.
You know, I think most people heat their food on too high a heat, and so the act of stirring is so they can heat it faster and not burn the bottom. And that's
you're that. It's one of those things where I always get frustrated when I'm, you know, when someone tries to help me in the kitchen, because I'll be like, okay, for me, and they won't stop touching them, so they don't brown. So it's like, oh God, what's happening? Try not to be neurotic, but yeah. But it's the same thing. So tangents aside, now you're going to want to kind of apply some low heat to 108 degrees specifically. Stir the curds occasionally, not a lot, stir them occasionally to keep them separated until they reach 108 degrees. This will take about 15 minutes. The curds will shrink and start to sink as the whey is expelled from them. So you'll start to kind of have a weird, I don't even know how to describe the image that we're looking at here, but it starts off, but at the end, it very clearly looks like there's this oily film sitting on top of a white mixture that's sitting on the bottom of the pot. And then, yeah, go ahead, Russ.
Oh, I was, yeah, it's, I think you described it right. It just looks like the whey has, the curds have just become, well, they're on the top, and, you know, and you have to cut them. It looks like they've changed. Now they're, like, heavier than the whey, and before they were lighter than.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So,
it's probably a chemical process as well.
It's a chemical process.
Probably. I'm going to go with that.
It's because of the reactions of the molecules. That's always the answer. The molecules are reacting. Or the curds. Okay. So turn off heat and continue stirring every few minutes for an additional 20 minutes. So here is kind of where we give you that green light for stirring every few minutes. Now drain the curds. Now, the person who's making this has their own kind of technique for draining the curds. It looks like he's going ahead and just kind of sifting them out with a hand sifter. But why don't you go ahead and use, if you really want to get all of the curds, use the step from the ricotta recipe where you line a sifter with cheesecloth and kind of pour it into a bowl. I think that would probably be just as efficient.
I think so, too. This one looks like a little bit more in just time intensive, just, you know, trying to scoop it out.
Exactly.
And then you try to get the corners, and then you don't get it all, and there's little bits. You're like, oh, I missed some curd, and then
just
exactly.
Exactly. So you want to drain those curds. Hopefully you've used our preferred technique. And you let them sit for about 15 minutes. And then just kind of either use a small strainer or dip it out or just pour it into a big bowl. He adds here, we're going to just pour it into a big bowl, let it sit for 15 minutes. And then once they've kind of sat in the strainer so that any excess moisture gets out, you want to pour those curds into a smaller bowl and break them up with your hand a little bit. Just there's kind of a difference. They're not all clumped together. And here's where it, quote, gets fun. So place the curds in the microwave on high for 30 to 45 seconds. If you have it on too long, you will cook the curd and it will turn to mush. So be careful here. I also want to note wattage. He doesn't say anything about, well, he does say something about wattage. If you have a high wattage, you know you have a high wattage microwave, you're going to probably want to do 15 to 30 instead of 30 to 45. But if you have just kind of a regular older microwave, 30 to 45 seconds should be fine. So heat the curd and then squeeze the curds using the slotted spoon, or your hand gently squeeze the whey from the curd. So when we say whey, we're referring to that kind of oily, wet mixture that's coming off of the mozzarella product at this point. And then pour off the whey and microwave it again. So repeat the last step. But this time you want to make sure that you microwave it for 15 to 20 seconds instead of the longer 30 to 45. If you have lower wattage, I'm going to suggest a simple 15 seconds. Then pour more of the whey off. And as you are gently squeezing the whey out, work it into a ball also. So this is really where it starts to look like mozzarella. The curds are naturally want to kind of clump together, so go ahead and just start forming it into a ball. Now the next step is where it's fun, stretching. You want to microwave it a third time, put it back in the microwave for 20 seconds, add salt. At this point, if it's warm enough, it should start to become pliable and stretchy, so kind of like just dough. When you're working the dough, grab 1/3 to 1/2 of the mass and lift. It should start to stretch under its own weight, and if not, put it back in the microwave for a few more seconds. And as you work through the stretching process, also knead it like bread a couple times. If necessary, microwave occasionally until your cheese looks like the one in the picture listed here. So really, this is going to be something, Russ, that I imagine a listener who wants to make this cheese is going to have to do one or two times before they kind of know how the mozzarella should look, how it should feel during the stretching process. But actually, you just want to make sure that it's sticking together and stretching. And then you just start stretching it. Work it into a ball. At this point, knead it like bread dough into a ball. If it breaks apart on you, just put it in the microwave again for a bit. So here we're using temperature to keep it as a kind of soluble working mass. Nice and smooth and shiny. It is done. And then you will have fresh homemade mozzarella cheese.
Well, it looks easy as well. It's a little more time, just a bit more like more steps in between than the ricotta.
Yes. And I think there are 20 steps here. Yeah. So.
And at the bottom here, and he says, with leftover whey, obviously you can make the ricotta cheese. Now, and I noticed this while I didn't read this before this, but the ricotta cheese is a kind of a high heat, you know, it's 190. Mm-hmm. This is like, you know, was 108, I think, was the highest temp he wanted us to keep the milk at.
Exactly.
So
that's a good point, Wes.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, they're both great recipes. I kind of like that you can get two cheeses for one, that nothing gets wasted in the second recipe. So it may be more time intensive. It may require a little bit more work, but if you have like having fun in the kitchen, this is an example of fun because you get to like play with dough like a kid. The purpose is to touch it and to stretch it. And that I think is fun. And I also think that nothing getting wasted is fun.
So I would say this along with my homemade, my homegrown tomatoes would be awesome.
Yeah, this is great, Russ. Put this on pizza is what I'm thinking. You know, mozzarella is the ultimate cheese for a crispy pizza. This just looks great.
Now, if you say I went to the grocery store, the mozzarella cheese you get from the grocery store is a harder mozzarella cheese.
Mostly because it's been refrigerated.
Well, I know, but even still, though, if you took a, I'm going to go back to my cheese head, the string cheese.
Yes.
If I left that out, it's not going to turn into kind of a blob. It's going to keep its structure, you know, without the little sleeve.
Right.
So I'm going to guess there's something in between there, the preservation process, how to make it last longer.
Sure.
They're doing that. I don't know. But is there something is there a secret that you know of that makes it harder?
I do know that temperature is a huge kind of contribution here. Although next time at the store, I'll flip over a mozzarella ball and just kind of look at the ingredients, because I'm certain there's some kind of preservative giving it that structure you're talking about. Most definitely with the string cheese. But when you look at these ingredients, the way in which you keep it soft and doughy is by constantly adding temperature during this process. So I think it's, you know, cold versus hot. At the bottom, I'm not sure if this is his image. It's, you see kind of a mozzarella ball sitting in a bowl.
It looks very dry. It's not at all kind of the soft kind of gooey ball looks like in the other pictures above.
Exactly. Yeah, it's very but I'm assuming this is maybe homemade cheese that's been refrigerated, because as you know, mozzarella is so much harder. You can cut into it. You can cut cubes out of it. Whereas with ricotta, it's just a spreadable cheese. So Yeah, I think it might be a temperature thing here. You know, I mean, this is cooked at such a low temperature, and then you refrigerate it, whereas the ricotta is cooked at such a high temperature, and then you refrigerate it. I'm not sure. We should do some research. And if anyone listening knows anything about this, please write in, because we would love to have some answers.
I'm sure there's a closet cheesemaker out there going, oh, I cannot believe that she just said that.
Please listen to me, Helena. I'm like, yes, I will read your long email. Please send it to me. So this is mozzarella and ricotta. I think we covered these two cheeses in detail, especially the mozzarella, so that kind of the steps are covered.
Well, I think it's cool, again, that you can make the mozzarella, turn around with the what's left over, make the ricotta. And then, seriously, that gallon of milk?
Yeah.
I mean, that is total reuse. I mean, or just, you know, getting the most out of that.
Yeah, I literally think you're taking a $4 or $5 gallon of milk, and you're getting $15 to $20 worth of cheese here.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, that in and of itself, it should be motivation to make this on a regular basis.
Seriously, it's like printing money.
It's like printing money. How do you save? How did you become rich, Russ? Cheese. It was all in the cheese.
No, seriously. If somebody wants to say, like, oh, I'm going to go to the farmer's market. What are you going to sell? Oh, I'm going to make my own mozzarella and ricotta cheese.
Good God.
Besides, you add time and Rennet tablets, whatever the heck those were.
Yeah, we're going to do some research, find some Rennet tablets. I don't think
who knows? Rennet tablets are probably $10 a piece.
Maybe not. or maybe they are. I just did a quick shopping search over at Google. You can get an 8-count or 8 to 12 count for $27. So that's a little pricey. They're a few dollars a tablet, clearly. Or you can get – actually, wait. No. That's a price – No. That person is price gouging, because there's an 8-tablet Rennet I don't want to use the word tablet again, but there are 8 Rennet tablets by the Junket brand, which is the one he's using, for $238 at Amazon with $199 shipping. So we'll have to put this in the show notes, because it looks like the Rennet tablets are just under $5. And you can make 8 different balls of mozzarella here.
Well, very good. Yeah, I'm looking on Amazon, and it's, what is it, Junket Rennet tablets. And $397 for the tablets.
Perfect.
So it's slow coming up here, but for 8 tablets.
Yes, and also
$2.38 for 8 tablets. So it's very low.
Yeah, and I just found a $3 bag of citric acid from Berry Farm, but the one that he uses is the Now brand citric acid, and that goes for about $6 with free shipping. So we'll put both of these in the show notes, because, you know, this is like anything in the kitchen. There are great benefits to making things at home in terms of price and taste and all of that stuff. But you do have to buy those ingredients initially. It's like when you buy cornstarch for the first time or baking powder.
And we all know how important it is to have fresh baking powder.
You know how important it is. We talked about that, didn't we?
Yes,
I think we did.
Oh, yes, we did. Yes, we did.
Okay, good. I'm so glad. I was having such a crisis. I was like going over my recipes like crazy, Russ, trying to figure out. And I was even testing some of the recipes to make sure they worked. And they did.
Why is Russ failing at all these recipes?
Why is the Padawan not the master yet? This doesn't make sense. It should have happened by now. I'm glad. Make sure you have fresh ingredients. So you're going to want to buy these.
Well, good. Yeah. So then they're not, you said like the citric acid, what did you mention the price? $5.59 for the little box of citric.
But that's free shipping at Amazon. So just stick it in your bag.
Get the prime. Get the prime. Come on, people.
Yeah. Get the prime. The prime is so important.
It is. All right. Well, good. And, so we've got another, let's say our final cheese recipe.
Yes. Is vegan, for all my vegan friends out there. And this one is the easiest, fastest recipe on the list. If you thought the ricotta cheese was fast, this is beyond fast. Because, you know, in the vegan community, a lot of the foods that they eat that are dairy-inspired in texture and content are often made from soy. So for fat-free vegan feta cheese, you need a block of tofu. And this recipe comes from The Happy Herbivore, which I love that name, which is a little food blog by Lindsay Nixon. And her ingredients list is super easy. If you're vegan or just have tofu around on a regular basis, all you're going to want to add to this is water, miso paste, which I have miso paste in my fridge, and you can get that at most Asian markets and pretty much at Whole Foods or Fresh Market in the specialty food section. Some red wine vinegar, some lemon juice, salt, and these are optional ingredients, but she adds them for flavor and taste. Basil, oregano, rosemary, and some nutritional yeast. Again, nutritional yeast is something you buy at a specialty store, but it's not terribly expensive. It's actually pretty cheap these days.
Well, I'm going to say, first off, in order to make the faux feta, there's a lot more ingredients.
Yeah, a lot more ingredients, but you're kind of adding something. There isn't a cooking chemical process here. Right. There's a stirring process. The work has really been done for you. You're just kind of flavoring the tofu to give it that feta taste. And we didn't include real feta because that's more of an advanced cooking technique, which we hope to get to in a future episode.
Right. So this is it's interesting because was most of the flavor come from the miso? Is that, I'm trying to figure out where the, because feta, I know I got feta. I had feta today in a salad.
Yeah.
It has a distinct taste.
It's a very sharp taste.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, miso, honestly, it does have flavor, but depending on the color of the paste and the kind of age of the paste, it may not be that flavorful, but it does give it flavor. So let me just say that. Yellow paste, I think, is a little bit sharper. I think, however, the taste that you're picking up on, Russ, is a combination of the red wine vinegar and lemon juice that they're creating here. So that's really going to give it that kind of really bright flavor that you're familiar with feta.
Okay.
But in terms of non-traditional feta, and oregano and rosemary, that's just going to complement it super nicely.
Yeah. Well, I've purchased feta from the grocery store that has, say, like cracked pepper.
Yes.
Oh, and that is the best to put on salads and things. And,
yes.
It is so good. But
just putting pepper on salad is so good. Most people are like, why is the salad so delicious? I don't know. Maybe I crack some fresh pepper on it.
Yeah. It's surprising how good it makes it.
Yeah. It's really good.
But so this is a good if you are vegan, vegetarian, if you don't want to go the milk route, this is a way to do it.
Yeah, and is gluten something that you find in dairy products? I'm sure it is. Yes.
Nope.
It's not. It's nope. Only in
it's a grain thing.
Flour and stuff?
It's a grain thing. It's I guess okay. But if there's say milk, you're talking about the casein. I don't know how to say that, but that's another things that, or lactose. If people are lactose intolerant, those are the two proteins in milk.
Yes.
So if you're allergic to all those things or any of them, this is your alternative. I want to taste. I want some feta cheese on my.
Yeah.
And I always say salad. And then she's mentioning here she puts it on her Greek salad, which is where most people I think put it on.
Yeah, but, feta goes great in any kind of crostini, kind of like we were talking about with the French bread and the ricotta.
Oh, yeah,
Yeah, there are tons of ways to use feta, but iconically it is a salad or a gyro ingredient.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
And especially the, and it mentions cucumbers, red onions, and feta cheese are, to use a term that the old kids used to say, the bomb.
They are the bomb, and I know you're not a fan of olives, Russ. We've had this conversation.
No, I am. I just didn't know I was.
You didn't? That's
remember,
right.
It was the Kalamata, and how unknown that what I was actually eating, and I thought the green ones were the Kalamata, and that wasn't the case. That was those nasty green pimento
things.
That's right.
Those are the cocktail olives. Yeah. But go ahead and spend $5 on that ricotta or that Kalamata olive because it is so flavorful and so delicious, and I guarantee if you mix it with this tofu recipe, it's going to taste like an authentic Greek salad. But Russ, I just realized we're ranting and raving because clearly you and I are feta enthusiasts, but we haven't actually talked about how you make this cheese for a vegan cook. So I'm going to startle everyone with the simple ingredient or the simple instructions. Add these ingredients to a bowl and stir. You're done.
No cooking involved. Yeah,
there's no cooking. And that's pretty much why I'm lumping it with ricotta cheese in terms of easiness.
So you're trading number of ingredients for cooking time.
Yeah.
So if you had no time, you're like, I want, here it is. There's
yes.
an easy and a way to do it. But it's going to take you more. Well, oh, sorry, there's something going on in the back here. If you don't have the ingredients you go and you have time, you go with the regular cheese. If you don't have time, but you've got ingredients, you go with the vegan feta.
Or if you have time, the ingredient, go with the vegan feta anyway and add it.
That's right.
Thyme is like my favorite herb in the entire
There's always the third option I'd ever remember.
Yeah, so this is a great recipe. And, you know, if you do, like you said, if you do have time, go with the non-vegan option. Because I think it's fun to bring science into the kitchen. It's more than just baking soda and vinegar when making your kid's science project. Why not? And you know what, Russ? Why don't you do a science project with your kids? How to make mozzarella or something. This just sounds like such a cool, fun family activity.
You know, inevitably, the kids have to do a science project. They're making it mandatory now. Because why? Because it's right before open house. They want that look. Like, oh, look at all the science the kids are doing.
We're not behind in the international race.
No. Look at our boards. Look at this. $6 each of all the parents spent on these boards and all the stuff they had to buy for that. Anyway.
But, oh, my God.
But making cheese in the process, the chemical process behind making cheese, it's an excellent way to learn that kind of that process, that chemical
it's
process.
A skill.
And then
yeah.
You can also have cheese afterward. You can eat it, too.
You can eat it. And, you know, I mean, I think that in our culture, food is so incredibly gendered and cooking is so incredibly gendered. And I think when you make it a scientific process, you teach little boys that, hey, it's cool to cook and it's fun to cook because you get to do bad, awesome things with a thermometer. And I was about to swear there, bad, awesome things with a thermometer and your dad over stovetop. So it's cool. Everyone knows what word I was probably going to put after bad, but
that's cool.
Family times.
I think you got that right. I think that's, and I know my son, my oldest son, Adam, he is in Scouts and he's often in charge of cooking on these campouts, and so he's constantly asking my mom, like, hey, is this something I can make and we're camping, you know, depending on what we're having that night. And then he's learning and kind of like modifying it, and like he's got limited resources and their cook boxes when they take out camping.
Yes.
So he's always trying to like, okay, can I do this? Is it one pot? Is it, you know, can I do it with a pot and a pan? I mean, what do I need to do to make this? And so he's always kind of trying to come up with different recipes that, you know, because they often come up with the same things. Well, I was having breakfast burritos, which is good because, you know, those do work out fine. Everybody likes them. But for dinner time, he's always coming up with different things. And last time he made, you know, tacos with all the different spices he brought from home. And it worked out really great. But he's always experimenting and he's getting into it, which is cool.
That is so cool. I would love for you to teach your son how to make mozzarella. You need to, like, report back if you guys do this experiment. Because I'm going to make ricotta for sure for the blog. Whether or not I get around to mozzarella soon is another issue. But I think it just seems like such a great experiment.
Well, today is Tuesday. My milk gets delivered tomorrow. And I forgot to cancel or shorten my milk delivery because I do have a milkman.
You have a milkman?
I do. And so I'm going to have, like, 7 gallons of milk. So I get 4 every week because the kids go crazy. I might only have 6, but I get 4 every week because the kids go through milk like crazy.
And
it's cheaper and they deliver right to your door. I don't have to like put it in the cart and it takes up all the cart room when you go to the grocery store. Anyway, I'm going to have like a lot of milk. So this is a real possibility here.
That's fantastic. I love it, Ross. You just made my day. Just knowing that you're going to be cooking with your son and doing this fun stuff is super cool. Okay, well, let's go on to the last recipe that we kind of tacked on here for funsies, and because it's kind of related to the cooking process, making your own homemade yogurt.
And this one's a lot shorter. I mean, this is, you know, by that mozzarella was, like I said, 20 steps and probably 20 at least photos there he was showing. There's no photos, and it's a tiny little write-up.
Yeah, are you looking at the Alton Brown one?
I am.
Okay, let's go off that one then, because I do have a second recipe link that if I didn't put it in the show notes. Oh, I do. Top of page 2 on our show notes, Russ. There's a biology department at some university that kind of did the photo by photo step process, very much like the mozzarella guy talking about how this works. So if you're looking for pretty much almost the same identical recipe, go ahead and check out the one at this university's website. But we're going to talk about Alton Brown's because it's super easy and super fast. So yeah, Russ, let's do this.
Yeah, well, this is really intrigues me because we talk a lot about on Fat Fit Radio about people always, you know, like you have plain yogurt and you cannot buy plain yogurt in the grocery store. Like it's almost non-existent anymore. They're always added sugars or something else that makes them
strawberries and craziness.
Yeah, something. You know, yeah. All these different flavors, you know, you get your orange.
Yeah, even the plain yogurt in my grocery store, it's assumed that it has to have a flavor to it. So it's plain / vanilla.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, I just want plain yogurt. And one of my favorite, I was a yogurt jockey back in the day, right? Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite flavors was natural. It was the plain yogurt. And
yes.
It was great. You put a boysenberry topping on that, little granola, you know, appeal to your inner hippie in that way. And it was so good. It was the best yogurt we made. And inevitably, it always went bad, and we had to pull it out of the machine because nobody ordered it because they didn't want it. They always wanted some flavor.
That's so crazy to me. Yeah, I'm actually, you know, I'm a huge fan of Greek yogurt. It's pretty much the only thing I keep in my refrigerator in terms of yogurt. And I love Greek yogurt, like a little bit of honey and granola and fresh fruit. It's just one of my favorite things. If you head over to Clearly Delicious, by the time this is posted, you will see a recipe for Greek yogurt with figs and granola. So let's bring the plain yogurt back, because I think it's some of the best in the world.
Yes. So what's the deal with Alton Brown's recipe here?
Well, the deal is that it's easy, and there are very few ingredients. you want 1 quart of 2% milk, a half cup of powdered milk. So for those of you who have powdered milk lying around for some random Betty Crocker baked good recipe, now is the time to use it for something else. 1 to 2 tablespoons honey, because you do want to give it some flavor. It's weird when it doesn't have any flavor.
It is, a little bit.
Yeah, so this is, you know, we talked about not having flavor, but honey is the original yogurt flavor. And then you want to have a starter, which is a half cup of plain yogurt, which you find at the store. I'm going to assume if you can't find Greek yogurt or regular plain yogurt, go ahead and get a basic vanilla yogurt. That just is like plain / vanilla. And over at the university website, the biology department suggests Dannon plain. So if you can find the plain made by the Dannon brand, that will work great as a starter too.
So interesting that the two recipes for yogurt include yogurt as an ingredient.
Yeah, I know, it's weird. It's it kind of makes me wonder.
It's the cultures, and it's those active yogurt cultures. I remember that was always a thing. People are always coming in, it's good for my stomach, when I was working at the Heidi's Frogen Yogurt. And
yes.
They would always come in after their, you know, they'd go to the gym, and they'd always talk about, I think they were trying to, you know, because I saw them so often because I worked a lot there, and I saw them so often that they would give me excuses why they were there so often. Like, it's good for my stomach, right? Yeah, you know that.
Yeah, but which one are you getting is the question.
Like, yeah, but did the hot fudge also help with your, and the chocolate chips also help with your stomach too? Because that wasn't really part of it.
They
right?
just help with your happy level. So, yeah, so exactly. It's cultures, and, you know, math is hard in my brain, and so I'm not going to spend any time figuring out how yogurt was first created without cultures, how you created a culture. Oh, my God, that sounds crazy. So was there a chicken before the egg, or was there just an egg? I don't know. So what I mean is you have to have a half cup of plain yogurt in order to kind of get this recipe started.
Yeah, and then it's interesting. He has – you don't cook it.
No.
He puts it under lined with a heating pad, in a bucket.
Yes.
Lined with a heating pad. So that's interesting. That is bizarre.
Well, Russ, the one thing that you need to know about Alton Brown, which I know that you know, and many listeners probably know, is that he's always doing something you can do on the stovetop in his own apparatus. Like, he's always creating some weird thing to prove that you don't always need a stove. You can do it this way because it's just as efficient. So, yeah. So let's talk about how you're going to get that heating pad out and use it. He says to go ahead and just pour the milk into a small saucepan and whisk in the powdered milk and honey so you can kind of integrate those ingredients. Place over medium heat and bring to 120 degrees. So make sure you have that thermometer on an instant read thermometer. Once milk has reached 120 degrees, pour into a cylindrical plastic container. Make sure that you reserve 1/2 cup. whisk in the reserved 1/2 cup into the yogurt and add back to the milk mixture. So this is how you're going to integrate that starter. Now here's where your wine bucket comes in, Wes. Place the container into a narrow wine bucket lined with a heating pad. Set the heating pad to medium. Let the mixture ferment for 3 to 12 hours, making sure the temperature stays as close to 150 degrees Fahrenheit as possible. After fermentation is complete, place into the refrigerator overnight. Whew. Also a science project.
It is, yes.
I'm not really sure. Do you have a heating pad, Russ?
I do.
Okay, so for you, this is fine.
When you get old like I am, Helena, you gotta have your heating pad. Things look better when you heat them up.
And on that note, that's true. So you'd have a heating pad. I guess my kind of question was, is this something most listeners are going to have? But I'm assuming we have a lot of listeners who do have them in their homes. I'm just one of those weird 20-somethings who don't own a heating pad yet.
Yet is the right word. Good. Well, Helena, these are all extremely... I'm just surprised that, like, they're just the especially the two recipes, the ricotta and the mozzarella, just the minimal ingredients need to make these great foods. And we're going to be able to make them so much cheaper than we can be able to buy them in the store, which is, the whole reason for this podcast was thinking, you know what, I want to make stuff at home, not pay out the nose for the stuff I know is simple to make. It's just that we've forgotten how to make it.
Exactly. No, you're completely right about that, because homemade is best. That's the name of our podcast, and it really is something that I think you and I truly believe, but it's through recipes like this that we can kind of prove that we can say, hey, this is one of the ways that, you know, it's going to be better than the store. And I guarantee you, the next time you and I make one of these recipes, we're going to be ranting and raving on the next podcast about how much better it is than store bought. So go innovation and heating pads.
Well, I am turning into a pumpkin, so we are going to get on to our basic food prep term of the week before we get out of here.
Now, this is a verb. Usually, I think we sometimes do verbs. And this is one that you probably use all the time, but maybe haven't spent too much time thinking about what it means. So the word that I need you to define is scald. What is the word scald mean?
Oh, I would say I usually only use this term with, like, milk.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it was heating at a high temperature and rapidly stirring or maybe not rapidly stirring. Maybe it's if I'm making a hot chocolate for the kids with milk, I would scald the milk, I think.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Am I
good.
Close?
You're very close. It is a cooking technique, as you said, and it is specifically used in the retardation of souring milk. So you use it to retard sour milk, the souring of milk, whereby a liquid is heated to just below the boiling point. So again, it's going to come to a point where you're scalding it right before it boils. Now there is, this term may sometimes be used with produce, such as tomatoes or peaches, when you throw them into boiling water, but that's a very different thing. It's actually the process of to blanch something, which I think we've talked about. But this is just something specifically for milk, and it relates to today's podcast, obviously, because we're dealing very specifically with temperatures and milk and making sure you keep them within a certain range.
Retard the souring of milk. Sounds like we're almost like, I don't know, just you're just killing off any bacteria. Is that what it is? Because it seems bizarre.
It is a very bizarre, random word usage here. But I mean, you know, we often think about this word in a psychoanalytic sense or in a psychological sense or even in a biological sense. But really, it just means to delay or hold something back in terms of its progress. So technically, I think that during the cooking process, when you expose milk to temperature, it can become sour or it can ferment. So when you're heating it up, it's going to something about slowing down that process to keep it from souring.
Yeah, we don't want to, and that's saying we don't want to boil the milk.
Right.
We want to just, okay.
A light simmer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I can, whenever I make homemade mac and cheese, I want to get that too. I want to get two, just don't want to boil it, but you want to get it nice and hot.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So perfect.
Good.
You did a great job, Russ. You keep acing your tests like this, you're going to be a Jedi Knight before too long.
Well, until we get to something more exotic.
Sure.
I hope we don't julienne anything.
Not that I can see, but I may ask you to debone something in the future.
Oh, all right, good.
But that's going to be down the road.
All right. Well, good. Well, that's going to do it then. I believe we have any emails or questions from listeners this time, do we?
No, you know, this was such an informative episode that I feel like it kind of had that element already. So maybe, I mean, we love listener mail. Please write in with any questions you have about these recipes, these techniques. If you know anything specifically about it, I'd love to hear it. And I can't remember which listener had requested the cheese episode. So once you listen to it, write in. Let's know if you're satisfied or have a hankering for other recipes.
Yes, and if you have a recipe that you'd like to share, like something like, oh, those are okay, but this one is the bomb. You can send those to Homemade is Best by clicking on our webpage, or going out to our webpage, homemadeisbest.com/feedback. That's where you can send us feedback there. Or you can just send us an email, feedback@homemadeisbest.com. Or you can go over to the Facebook page, facebook.com/homemadeisbest.
Yes, and like us on Homemade is Best, because, you know, I think we have a lot of listeners. Let's get as many likes over there as possible.
Yeah, we may have that page fill up with information, recipes, and things from y'all.
Y'all. Yes. I like it.
All right, good. Well, thanks, Elena. Seriously, this is a great episode, and I can't believe that I'm thinking about making cheese, but that's what's going on in my brain right now. So
I love it. It'll be fun. I'm excited. And thanks, Russ. It's fun to bounce these weird ingredients and recipes off you. I always enjoy it.
It's fun for me too. I hope it's fun for you at home, and thank you for joining us here on Homemade is Best, and we will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.